Chapter 25. On Saturday morning, Greg parked the Duo in a side street just outside New Eastfield and handed over a fiver to the local teeny-bopper extortionists before walking out into the plush precinct's tranquil boulevards. He'd used the Event Horizon card to splash out on new light grey slacks, blue canvas sneakers, and a jade-green pure-wool Stuart sweater. His usual jeans and T-shirt would have aggrieved the private police squad, which New Eastfield's residents employed. One major contributory factor to Peterborough's post-warming prosperity had been its burgeoning maritime links. The Neen allowed cargo ships to sail right into the heart of the city. They docked at a new port and warehouse complex, which had sprung up in the place of the old shopping precinct and Queensgate Mall. In addition to the commercial shipping, an armada of nearly 7,000 small boats had set out from the Norfolk Broads as the Antarctic ice melted, converging on the city. They'd anchored around the island suburb of Stanground, their moorings evolving into a hugely complicated maze of jetties built out of timber scavenged from the roofs and floors of deluged buildings out in the fens. The boats at the centre were trapped there now, 10 years' worth of rubbish clogging the water around them, embedding them in an artificial bog. He'd heard that around 10,000 people lived in the sprawling boat town. The actual figure was uncertain. Stanground's inherent chaos made council hall governance nigh on impossible, an aspect which the residents took full advantage of. The narrow, twisting channels were Peterborough's main haven for smugglers, pumping hard currency euro francs into the city's economy. Finally, there was an impressive squadron of pleasure craft. The potential of the city's industrial vigour, coupled with the kind of seedy spice endemic to monstrous overcrowding, proved a powerful attraction to Europe's ship-borne rich. People who ran their mini-empires of financial trusts and venture projects from floating gin palaces. They were a flock in eternal migration, never in one port long enough to qualify for the taxman's attention. They had their own marina in New Eastfield, north of the Neen's main course. The quays were concrete, substantial, immaculately clean. Every requirement was catered for, from stores supplying five-star food and maritime gear to a not-so-small dry dock capable of providing complete refits. Greg hit the marina itself around 11, a whole community of clubs, sports complexes, shops, restaurants, and pubs along the waterfront, open to permit holders only. Royan had loaded his ID into the membership computer. The promenade was a kilometre long, built from huge granite cubes. Five quays stabbed out into the deep harbour that had been dredged for the yachts of the mega-rich. A gauzy layer of cumulus cloud diffused the sun into a sourceless light overhead. The humidity this close to the Fens basin approached steam bath levels. He found Angelica's, a single-story flat-roofed emporium opposite the center quay, where the Miriam was berthed. It was a food hall selling wholesale quantities of nouveau delicacies he didn't even know how to pronounce. Greg walked down the cul-de-sac side alley and found the delivery bay's metal roller door at the rear. Beside it, embedded in the bricks, was a series of metal rungs. He started to climb. The uniformity of the solar collector roof was broken by two satellite dish weather domes and three big conditioning stacks, their fans spinning silently. Dead center was a box structure of slatted wooden panels which housed Angelica's water tanks. Greg crouched down and scuttled over to it. One of the slat panels was hanging loose. He pulled it aside and slipped in. The panel opened into a narrow gap between two big water tanks, 1.5 meters wide, 3 long. There wasn't enough headroom to stand up, and he had to hunch down with his hands brushing the floor. What space there was had nearly been used up. At the far end, various photon amp lenses were poking through the slats, their cables feeding a jumble of compact gear modules. Weird little halos of coloured light cloaked 5 miniature flat screens, which flickered with the image of the good ship Miriam, half covered with red digital readouts. Right in front of the entrance panel was a pile of drink cans and food wrappers. Greg nearly put his foot in an adult-sized potty that had been connected into Angelica's plumbing by a ribbed, flexible pipe. There was only one smell. Ripe human. Between the rubbish and the gear was a thin yellow sponge mattress. Susie was lying on it, wearing blue shorts, soaked a shade darker by sweat. Her mauve spikes had drooped in the torrid heat. She peered at him out of the gloom.
"Christ, about time you showed. See what we've been suffering for you."
"All in a good cause." He stepped over the potty and squirmed onto the mattress beside her. One of the gear modules poked sharply into his back.
"Cozy,"
Susie smirked spryly.
"You want to do it? There's enough room if you ain't into anything too kinky."
Greg was suddenly very aware of her tough little body pressing against him.
"We'd die of heat exhaustion."
"Yeah, tits the size that new girl of yours was stacked with. Can't say I blame you."
Greg nearly started to protest, but thought better of it.
"I hope you're not handling the observational by yourself. This heat is bad for you. Seriously."
A growl rumbled up from the back of her throat.
"Shit, no. It's 4-hour shifts only up here. The rest of the squad is spotted round the marina. Some of them signed on with the company that's got the franchise to keep the promenade clean. And there are another 2 in hire cars for tailing Kendricks's Jag when he goes runabout. We've been drawing up her habits and behavior profile. Just like you taught us, right? Know the man. Get to understand him. No hassling that. Talks pretty loose around here. One of us made bombing at a pub the crews use. Nothing they like better than slagging off their owners."
"Sounds good so far. What have you got for me?"
Susie wriggled a hand free and pointed at the screens.
"This Kendrick, he's a fucking Martian, not of this earth, you know. The lives these yacht people lead, unbelievable. Tell you something, though, no way is he a card carrier. I mean, the PSP's local chair pricks, they had it all, right? Eternal junket time. But they haven't got nothing compared to this geezer. The money he's got. He wouldn't last 5 minutes if they ever got back in power."
Ah. He'd wondered about the peak of vexation in her mind. "No, Kendrick's not party, but my guess is that he's involved in a spoiler against Event Horizon. And with the economy all shaky with inflation right now, Event Horizon taking a tumble would be serious bad news. The only people who'll benefit are the PSP relics in legitimate opposition. That good enough for you?"
"What's the spoiler?"
"Ministry of Defense. Ultra hush."
"Figures?"
She agreed without much enthusiasm.
"Son told us Kendrick was plugged into big league corporate operations."
Greg studied the various images on the 5 screens. Miriam was the biggest yacht in the marina, 65 meters long, gleaming silver white, with jet black ports. Crewmen stripped to the waist were visible, washing down the wide after deck.
"Is Kendrick on board right now?"
"Yeah, as always. Believe me, nothing at all happens in this marina before noon. They're all too busy sleeping off last night's orgies. Right now it's business time for Kendrick. He holds a couple of conference sessions in the mid-deck lounge each day. There's a whole bunch of square-ass lawyer types who turn up each morning to see him. Don't know what they rap about in the cabin. Miriam's ports are screened. But anything they say out on the deck, we've got on a Memox cartridge for you." Her eyebrows puckered up. "Isn't that Julia Evans girl in charge of Event Horizon now?"
"Yeah. She owns it."
"No shit."
"Heard Kendrick on about her." Susie began typing on a keyboard.
"Remember the file code,"
she muttered, and consulted a cyberfax.
"Here we go."
One of the small screens changed to a scene on the Miriam's broad afterdeck. Greg squinted down at it. Kendrick was sitting on one of the plastic recliners, dressed in an open-neck shirt and tailored shorts, drinking from a tall cut crystal glass. The man with him was in a suit, his collar undone, tie hanging loose. He looked to be in his late 40s, a flat bulldog face with red skin.
"Here,"
said Susie. She handed Greg an earpiece.
"Missing out badly,"
the man in the suit was saying, in a faint Scottish brogue. "Our party is damn near down, Kendrick. It cannot last long. Terrible thing, food short. There's no gear, no methane for the farms. People are going to the spivs like never before. There's a hell of a turnover in silver right now.
If you could just have a wee word with young Julia Evans. Come to an arrangement where, till the party goes down, I can ship her out by the ton."
"Impossible," Kendrick said flatly.
His face was dangerously hard.
"That frigid bitch and I have severed all our business contracts. There will be no resumption."
"'Tis a lot of money, Kendrick."
"Ride it out. I'm closing some deals that will make the black currency market utterly trivial. And I certainly shall not forget your forbearance."
The man in the suit shook his head sadly and took a drink from his glass. The image froze.
"Didn't mean much at the time,"
said Susie. She pecked at the keyboard again. This time it was evening. A gauzy layer of cumulus cloud glowed copper above the Miriam. There was a crowd of about 15 people drinking on the afterdeck, the women in low-cut cocktail dresses, men in suits or blazers. Laughter, glamorous conversation, and the chink of glasses filled the earpiece. Kendrick was standing at the stern with two other men, one tall and slim with thinning blonde hair, the second a handsome African in brightly coloured northern tribal robes.
"You have got to provide the house with alternative investments, Kendrick," said the blonde-haired man, "and fast." "I've acquired some options in a Pacific Rim portfolio," the African said earnestly. "They'll give you a 16% to 17% return, guaranteed minimum."
"No," Kendrick said.
"You won't find anything better, not short term."
"I'm sorry.
I know how hard you work to put them together, but no."
"You should have hung on, Kendrick," said the blonde man. "We could have squared it with the family over Seabrook."
Kendrick's handsome features darkened.
"That deranged little shit, Evans. Buying a fucking bank. I've never heard of anything so...
He clutched at the polished brass taffrail.
"God damn that bitch!"
The blonde man turned to look out over the marina.
"Look," said the African. "The family is going to insist on an equivalent viability from the money released by pulling out of the Event Horizon backing consortium."
Kendrick didn't respond.
"The family," began the blonde man. "Put them off," Kendrick snapped.
He caught himself and rested a companionable hand on the blonde man's shoulder.
6 months, Clancy. If I haven't come through by then, I'll step down from the family board anyway. Okay?"
Greg considered the faces on the screen. The two financiers' obvious concern. Kendrick's driving anger. And intuition was totally spurious. A cornered animal had no choice in the way it reacted.
"Have you got a record of all the visitors?"
he asked. Susie tapped the sensor array with possessive pride.
"No sweat. Day or night, anyone on or off gets tagged. We've got infrared and low level for night work. Not that we need them. That baby is lit up like a football pitch after dark. And we've got an antenna rigged to intercept Miriam's local calls. But there's nothing we can do about her satellite uplinks. Trouble is, the local calls have all been the big zero so far. Social gabbing and ordering booze, that kind of crap."
Greg grunted and wiped some of the sweat off his forehead.
"Good. If I know who he's been seeing, I might be able to get a clearer idea of exactly what he's planning."
"You figuring on doing an extra parliamentary number against him?"
"Insufficient data."
She bent back and dragged a cool can of orange from the heap at her feet.
"I'd like in if it happens."
She twisted the tab 90 degrees. Greg watched frost forming over the can with something akin to lust.
"No promises. As I said, this is big league. Black hat spooks with viral wasps and funny midnight accidents."
Susie pulled the tab and gulped down the icy stream of bubbling orange, burping loudly.
"Figures?"
"So, what happens in the afternoon?"
"She, Hermione, right? Goes shopping. Maybe there's lunch with a load of airhead cows just like her. Evening they party, sometimes on one of the other yachts, mostly on theirs. About 25 came to it last night. Then after midnight they take off for the Blue Ball. That's a casino in New Eastfield. Hottest spot in town, people say. We tailed them for you, but no fucking way could we get past the bouncers. They pack up around 3 or 4 and come straight back. Spoke to a couple of the casino's waitresses, though. They reckon Kendrick and Hermione usually pick up a girl at the Blue Ball, bring her back to Miriam to provide themselves with some fun. These waitresses, a friend of theirs let herself get talked into going along with them once. Bad scene, Greg. No sadism, but she was really put through her paces. Kendrick and Hermione screwed her brains out. Then she got kicked off the next morning. Apparently they all do. One-nighters. Fuck and forget."
"What about the crew?"
Susie grinned knowingly.
"Just in case you're thinking of visiting, right? There's 9 real crew, sailor types, including the captain. On top of that, you've got 7 assorted staff, cooks, maids, and such. Then there's 6 bodyguards, mean-looking bastards. Oh, here."
She leaned over him, tiny pointed breasts squashing against his cheek, damp and salty. He detected a glint of amusement in her mind. She scrabbled amongst the gear modules and came back with a Memox crystal.
"This has got all the visitors' faces and times they turned up. We managed to get names for a few of them."
One of the flat screens switched to the Miriam's blueprints.
There are always at least 4 people left on board, Susie said, pointing at it. We think we've got their cabins assigned, but you can never be sure.
Names had been superimposed over the various cabins.
Great. Where did you get the specs from?
Greg asked.
Sun snatched them. Miriam's hull was built in Finland, but she was fitted out up in Tyneside. Apparently the English are still unbeatable when it comes to quality handicrafts.
Greg squirted the Memox crystal data into his cybofax and began skipping through the faces. The images were good, high definition. Most seemed to be staring straight into the lens. Morgan Walshaw should be able to assemble profiles on them.
Oh, yeah, Susie muttered. They've got themselves a permanent doxy on board, too. She don't do much, too fucking stoned the whole time by the look of her. That Kendrick, menage a quatre every night, some stud, eh?
Greg flipped through the index until he came to the girl. She'd been given a number, but no name. Her face appeared on the Cyberfax's little screen.
That's some looker,
Susie said, craning over his shoulder.
Wouldn't mind her for myself.
Has she been on board the whole time?
Yeah, since we've been watching anyway. Why, you know her?
Yes. Her name is Katerina Cawthorpe.
So why, first, Julia's friend up with Kendrick de Girolamo?
I don't know the specifics, Greg said, his voice raised, strained.
Royan was jittering about in his dentist's chair, shoulders jerking in an erratic, pumping rhythm. Royan was having one of his bad days, and when Greg considered just how shitty even Royan's good days must be...
Connected?
There is no such thing as coincidence.
Was I helping you with 10 times?
The catheter bag, which dangled below the chair on a chrome coat hook, was filling with an oily, bilious liquid.
Big help. He was a blackmail victim, not a proper hot rod. Someone has been feeding him sophisticated viruses to use on burns.
Think he was too quick to go solo. Not shit, and then not good enough circuit scores to handle. Hurts, Greg. Really hurts me.
And how could he answer that? He smiled broadly, feeling a prized turd.
Hey, you made a friend in Eleanor. She's planning on coming back.
Beauty and the bees. Horrible, nasty filth. You screw babies, babies, make babies together. I want shit filth. Away.
Greg couldn't move, revolted and horrified. He wanted to get out and never come back, break free. The Trinities, the Constables, Blackshirts, this tower, this room, Royan. They were all facets of his ingrained guilt. Soul-devouring. Don't cry. He rubbed knuckles into his eyes, vision blurring.
Quick, why come?
Coy appeared in the kitchen door, concern marring her fragile, sensitive features. She flashed Greg a look he couldn't begin to interpret.
Why?
I needed you to run a finance backtrack for me. I think it's the missing link, the one that'll tie Kendrick to the hot rods.
The screens exploded into an incoherent image mash. Channel shows. Himself seen through Royan's eye camera. Sticky tears smearing his cheeks. Mad computer graphics, starchy neat data tables dissolving into tight vortices of green and blue alphanumerics. One of the little trash robots trundled across the floor, gears grinding harshly, and bumped into a plant trough. It backed off and hit the trough again and again, bewitched with a mindless insect sentience. Coy was at Royan's side, pinching his nose with one hand, trying to push a feed bottle's nipple into his mouth. He flung his head from side to side. A desperate thrumming sound rose in his throat. A multitude of red and green LEDs lit up on one of Royan's cranky gear consoles. Greg retrieved the memory O'Donnell had given him from his cybofax and showed it to the console, squirting. The screens were showing a giant still picture of Trafalgar Square. Greg recognized it instantly. A euphoric classic. The day the PSP fell, beamed out live by every channel in the world, the crowd singing God Save the King, orange flames rising from 100 PSP banners, 10,000 Union Jacks waving in joyful celebration, a residue of smoke from Downing Street boiling through the air. The scene was swelling, individual pixels becoming golf ball-sized, a nonsense mosaic. Royan sounded as though he was choking. Coy had got the nipple into his mouth. He was sucking frantically, treacly globs of mashed apple running down his chin, dribbling onto an already badly stained T-shirt. Behind Greg, the robot suddenly stopped its mad battering. There must have been something in the apple. Royan was visibly wilting.
"You go now, please,"
Coy said, bowing from the waist. The lunatic kaleidoscope shrank as the screens began to wink out one by one. Coy's small, expressive eyes were filled with a sorrow that had no right inhabiting someone her age.
"Nothing more you can do."